Chapter 9. Christmas. And a dismal time they would have had of it too, but for a singularly fortunate encounter in the first dim light of December the 24th, when the forecastle lookout reported two fishing boats directly to leeward. Fishing in the bay was a dangerous pursuit, for quite apart from storms, rocks and tide races, the French authorities punished contact with any ship of the blockading squadron very severely indeed, sometimes with death. And whenever there was even tolerable visibility, watchers with telescopes kept the fishermen in view, while both setting out from port and return were registered. The two boats in question, therefore, did their best to get away, but they were horribly embarrassed by their catch. A vast net, not only crammed with mackerel, but also with the porpoises that had been pursuing them, and that were now hopelessly entangled in fold upon fold of twisted mesh. Happily, the fishermen were on the Bellona's seaward side. They couldn't have been seen from the shore, even if the light had been far better. Harding quickly had the quarterboat lowered, and in a brisk exchange bought net, mackerel and porpoises for 2 guineas. They were hoisted aboard with infinite goodwill, and almost all the mackerel, as fresh as ever fish could be, were eaten for breakfast, while the porpoises, rather strangely jointed by the ship's butcher, were served out for Christmas dinner and declared better, far better than roast pork. They were, however, but the faintest, most wistful of memories a month or so later. A month still quite bare of storeships, post or news, other than vague rumours of French reverses in Leipzig and of more convincing recoveries in other places far away, when, according to their custom, the Bellona's captain and her surgeon met for breakfast. "Morning, Stephen," said Jack. "Have you been on deck?" "I have not. Good morning to you, however. What little air came down from the hatches as I walked along was so very disagreeable that I chose rather to make my morning rounds before breakfast, close, fetid and nasty though it was down there, in spite of my ventilators. And I'm afraid it is but a fetid, nasty and goddamn meagre breakfast that's waiting for you now, very far from the delights of Black's or even Woolcombe. Yet at least the coffee, though precious thin, is liquid and still reasonably hot. Allow me to pour you a cup." Having done so, he went on. "If you'd not gone below, you would have seen a prodigious curious sky. With the glass rising and falling so often, I really don't know what to make of it. Nor does the master. I wish Jan were still aboard. In these waters, it's a joy to have a pilot who's fished the whole bay since he was a youngster. I may well be wrong, but I'm fairly sure of that odd mixture of strong wind and fog that we met with, that we suffered from off Patagonia." They spoke of Patagonia, that uncomfortable shore, made glorious only by the presence of a gigantic sloth, a ground sloth, unseen, it's true, by literate man, but certainly skinned by his earlier illiterate cousins. Stephen possessed 18 square inches of hide and part of a knuckle bone. "I was called with the other idlers this morning," said Jack, "but unlike them, I lay for a while. And I reflected upon the extraordinary, and I'm afraid very ungrateful way I jibbed at the word probability when we were talking about your beautiful scheme some time ago. You may have forgotten it, I hope so. But I spoke as though I could conceivably have the certainty of a flag. A flag promised years ahead, which is great nonsense. Apart from anything else, I still have a great many years to serve. There are quantities of people ahead of me on the list who must die or disgrace themselves before I can really hope for anything. And praying for a bloody war and a sickly season don't seem to answer nearly as quickly as one could wish. Nevertheless, it would make the probability much more probable if, as you so kindly put it, I were to distinguish myself in the meantime and wipe out some of the uncivil reports that have been made about me. So, do you see, I quite withdraw any implied fling at the word probability. Though, on the other hand, I do cling cling with all my might to reinstatement. You did use the word reinstatement, did you not?
I did.
And as I recall, it was quite unqualified.
There is no more beautiful word in the English language,
which, I am told, is richer than the Hebrew, Chaldee, or Greek. How I honour that dear Sir Joseph.
What is it, Killick?
Preserved Killick walked in with a look of surly triumph on his disagreeable, shrewish face, and said, jerking his head in Stephen's direction,
"Which I only wanted to ask His Honour where this little green parcel was to go. In the dispensary? Down the head?"
"Jesus!" Stephen checked himself and went on. "It had flown out of my head entirely with the anxieties of the journey and the tumult of the waves. It's a troy pound of Jackson's best mocha. He sells it by troy weight as a precious substance, which indeed it is. Good Killick, honest Killick, pray grind it as fast as human power allows and make up a noble great pot." Killick had never been called honest before, and he wasn't at all sure how he liked it now. He sidled out with suspicious glances back into the cabin. "Another point I reflected upon as I lay there this morning," said Jack, "was your notion that this war might be over quite soon. As for the political side of things, I'm sure you know much more than I do, but there's also the naval side, and all things being equal, it's weight of metal that decides a battle at sea. A 12-pounder frigate cannot take on a ship of the line."
"There have been exceptions,"
said Stephen, smiling.
"Oh, surely not,"
said Jack. Then, catching the allusion, his 14-gun sloop Sophie had captured the 32-gun frigate Cacafuego, he went on,
"Well, yes, there are exceptions, but broadly speaking, it's true.
And the French are now building ships at a great pace in Venice along the Adriatic, where they have much more oak than we have now, and better. Genoa, Toulon, La Rochelle. And here in Brest there's immense activity, as well as down the coast. I cannot state it as a fact that we're outnumbered, but I'm very sure that we soon shall be." "My dear, you said all other things being equal. But surely it's generally admitted that they're not equal, that our seamanship is very much better than theirs. On land, it's generally admitted that we're the very pink of perfection and that Heart of Oak Towers cannot put a foot wrong. But the Americans showed us that we were not quite infallible, and showed us in fair fight, too. And as for the French, they've always built better ships than our people could do. Our 74s and most of our frigates are modelled on their lines. Your own dear Surprise was built at Havre. We certainly were better seamen at the beginning of these wars, when their absurd revolutionary ideas practically wiped out their old seasoned officers. But although that Napoleon is, as you say, a mumping great villain, he has at least knocked all these pernicious democratic and republican notions on the head. And by now there's a new race of French sea officers, certainly not to be underestimated. The Admiralty don't underestimate them, I can tell you. We've been reinforced to a remarkable extent." Jack was called away at this point, and Stephen, having emptied the pot, made his way below, where an unhappy patient awaited his knife, already held down by leather-padded chains, already calmed to a certain degree by 30 drops of laudanum, his belly already washed and shaved, with his particular friend and tie-mate already standing by to comfort him. The operation was a suprapubic cystotomy, and it was one that Stephen had often carried out, almost always with success. He approached this particular case with an unstudied calm that soothed the poor, rigid, sweating seaman more than the laudanum, more than his friends. "All over very soon, mate. Just a twinge or so, and Bob's your uncle." Cast his eye over the range of instruments that his assistant had laid out, took off his coat, reached for the alcohol and said, "Now, Bowden, am going to pour spirits of wine over your belly to take away the pain. But at first you may feel a little stab. Don't fling away, or I may not be able to come to the trouble.
Carry on, sir, if you please,
said Bowden. I shall not sing out.
His mate nevertheless tightened the chain a full link, and indeed the first incision drew a shuddering gasp from the patient. Shuddering gasps had no effect of any kind on the surgeons, however, and they worked steadily on, passing needles, passing forceps, until the last suture was looped, pulled firm, cut short, and the trembling but infinitely relieved patient dismissed to the sick berth, carried by Graves, the senior loblolly boy, once a horse knacker, and Butcher, then and now his assistant, and followed by Bowden's messmate, the paler of the two, but crammed with matter for conversation on the mess deck.
"Pray, sir," asked Macaulay, "why do you use the spirits of wine? Have they a particular virtue?"
"The sudden chilling from evaporation has some slight effect. The knowledge that the surgeon wishes to avoid giving pain probably has more. But, upon the whole, I use it empirically, no more. Durantin, who taught me at the Hotel Dieu, always used it, above all when he opened an abdomen. And he was a remarkably successful surgeon. So I do the same. Perhaps out of a superstitious reverence for my master."
"I shall certainly imitate you," said Macaulay, "cost what it may."
Stephen wiped his hands, put on his coat, climbed the ladder, and reached the quarter-deck.
"Good morning, sir," said Harding. "Have you come up for a breath of air?"
"I have, if you have any to spare."
"Oh, I assure you there's enough for all hands. But should you not like a tarpaulin jacket with a hood, at least? Mr. Weatherby, jump down to my cabin and fetch the doctor a Grego. There's one hanging against the bulkhead."
It came in time to protect Stephen from a stinging gust of rain, and Harding said, "I'm afraid this is really very disagreeable weather. I had hoped you'd see our new reinforcements all spread out on the azure main. Grampus is somewhere over there," nodding into the greyness on the starboard beam. "She'll certainly not be far off. Faithorn has her, and he don't know the bay, so naturally enough he keeps very close."
"Naturally indeed, since the Bellona was on her usual southern patrol, heading for the Pointe du Raz and its horrible reef, rocks, tide races, things abhorrent to a blue water sailor."
"What is the Grampus?"
asked Stephen. "She's that unhappy thing, a 50-gun ship," said Harding. "A fourth rate with 50 guns on two decks. She's incapable of fighting a 74, a ship of the line, of course, and her two decks make frigates run. Even if she does catch and take one, there's no glory in it, while if she's beat, as well she may be, by one of the heavy American or even French frigates, it's total disgrace."
"The wind's backing northerly," he observed in passing.
"Then we have another 74, the Scipion, taken in Strawn's action, and a couple of frigates, Eurotas, I'm very sure, and Penelope, as pretty as her name. And sometimes the Charlotte looks in to see how we're getting along. Never a week goes by without a cutter or two from the offshore squadron. We used to cheer them ashore of letters, news, slops, or at least something to eat. But no such thing. They only come for reports from the craft that have looked into Brest, and for the usual returns. Numbers in the sick list, quantity of water remaining, powder, round shot. Mind out, sir! The making tide threw a freakish wave curling over the starboard hammock nettings, knocking Stephen down, and in spite of the tarpaulin jacket, soaking him with a quite extraordinary thoroughness, so that water ran from every part of his person, every garment that covered him. Harding picked him up and dabbed ineffectually with a handkerchief, apologising as he did so. He seemed to feel that it was all his fault. And this opinion was shared, strongly shared, by the two elderly seamen to whom Stephen was delivered, Joe Place and Amos Dray, the doctor's shipmates this many a year, and now members of the afterguard, who propped him aft to the warm, dry cabin, with many an indignant glance at their first lieutenant.
Killick changed and dried him. Nothing more fatal than damp feet. And seeing that dinner would be up very soon, urged him, since he practically qualified as a patient, to eat very sparingly. Only 2 glasses of wine and water. Pudding couldn't be recommended. It was apt to weigh on the vital spirits. Jack came in, as wet as Neptune, from the main top, where he'd been surveying the weather and all the bay that was visible with keen attention. "I do ask pardon for being so late," he called from his sleeping cabin, where he was toweling himself with great force. "I shall not be a moment." Nor was he. Clean, dry shirt and breeches had he found at once. But the only coat immediately at hand was that of the Rear Admiral's uniform, which he had necessarily worn in his last commission, a voyage to West Africa that he'd made as a commodore commanding a squadron. A commodore of the first class, no less. "This was the only dry coat I could lay my hands on without being later still," he said, looking at the broad expanse of gold lace on the sleeve with some complacency. "I quite like to wear it now and then, though the dear knows whether I shall ever appear in it publicly again." Killick muttered something and set a blaze of silver down before him. "This liquid's technically known as soup," Jack went on, having taken off the cover. "May I ladle you out a measure?" "Oh, it's pleasant enough to see the remnants of peas so aged and worn that even the weevils scorned them and died at their side. So that now we have both predator and prey to nourish us. And what is pleasanter still is to see the infamous brew spooned from that gleaming great tureen, the gift of the grateful West India merchants. We tried to sell the whole service, you know. But happily the silversmiths turned up their noses. I'm very glad of it now, because however poor you are, and nobody could be much poorer in reality than sailors in a ship without any stores, what crusts you may scrape together eat with more relish in handsome silver. Next came a truly villainous piece of salt beef that had travelled to the North American station and back in its time, growing steadily more horny and wooden as years went by. Jack ate it without concern. He'd grown and thrived on worse. And as he ate, he said, "I was telling you about the French Navy's seamanship at breakfast, and I was on the very point of giving you a splendid example when I was interrupted. I did tell you that we'd been reinforced, did I not?" Stephen bowed. "Well, one of our new frigates is Eurotas, my splendid example in person. But I dare say you heard all about Eurotas in London." Stephen shook his head. "I know the Eurotas only as a Spartan stream, and Sparta made no part of our conversation in London at any time. Well, early in the year, 2 frigates got out of Brest. They parted company somewhere about the Cape Verdes after a fairly successful cruise, and when she was homeward bound, one of them, the Clorinde, which carried 28 18-pounders to 8-pounders and 14 24-pounder carronades, fell in with Eurotas. Captain John Phillimore, a 38-gun, 24-pounder frigate, a very powerful vessel, throwing a broadside of 601 pounds, as opposed to Clorinde's 463. In size and number of crew, they were about equal. Eurotas saw Clorinde first at 2 o'clock in the afternoon in 47 degrees 40 minutes north. The wind southwest by south, the Clorinde close-hauled for home on the starboard tack. Eurotas at once bore up in chase, having no doubt of the Clorinde's nationality. 30 minutes later, the Clorinde bore up too, packing on sail. By 4 o'clock, the wind had veered nor-west, slackening, yet still the Eurotas gained. When the Clorinde was rather less than 4 miles ahead, she suddenly shortened sail and made as though to cross Eurotas' hawse. This brought the 2 ships much closer. And at 4:45, Eurotas bore up. Jack moved one of the 2 pieces of biscuit with which he was making the manoeuvre clear, and passed under Clorinde's stern, firing her starboard broadside. But then, as she luffed up under the enemy's quarters, the Frenchman fired so fast and straight that by the time the Eurotas reached Clorinde's larboard bow, they brought her mizzenmast down.
It fell over her starboard quarter, and at much the same time Clarine's foretopmast carried away. This didn't prevent her from shooting ahead, however, and she tried to cross Eurotas' bows and rake her fore and aft. Stephen shook his head. He'd seen the results of a full broadside tearing right down the whole length of a crowded ship. But, however, Fillmore clapped his helm hard aport and luffed up, meaning to board her. Yet the wreckage of the mizzen made that impossible, and all he could do was fire his larboard broadside into her stern. This brought them side by side again, and they blazed away until 6:20, when the Eurotas had her mainmast shot away. Can you imagine that, Stephen? A mast 2 feet 3 across. But luckily it fell to starboard, her unengaged side, so the gunfire wasn't interrupted. Then the Clarine's mizzenmast came down, while at 6:50, the ship still being in much the same posture, Eurotas' foremast fell over her starboard bow, and a minute or so later Clarine too lost her mainmast. Eurotas, mastless, was unmanageable. Clarine almost so, though a little after 7, when she was on the Eurotas' larboard bow, she managed to set what was left of her foresail, for you remember she'd lost only her foretopmast, and a forestaysail, and moved away southeast out of gunshot. Captain Fillmore had been wounded early in the fight, fainted 3 times from loss of blood, and now he went below. By 5 the next morning, his people, under the first lieutenant, had sent up a spare maintopmast as a jury main. By 6:15, a foretopmast for a jury foremast, and a rough spar for the mizzen. The Clarinde was now 6 miles ahead. By noon, with jury courses, topsails, staysails and spanker set, Eurotas was making 6.5 knots and obviously gaining. Then, of course, what heaved up? Why, Dryad, of course. A 36-gun, 18-pounder frigate you know quite well. And Achates, a 16-gun sloop. But that's not the point. Nor how the prize money, gun money, head money and the like was shared out. No, my point is that now, at present, a Frenchman, inferior in metal and in sailing qualities, is so well manned and so well officered that she can fight like 10 bulldogs and reduce one of our heaviest and best frigates to a dismasted hulk. That's why it makes me uneasy to hear of them building at such a rate. In spite of poor Eurotas, I should still feel confident of engaging any French 74 we might have the good fortune to meet, but I should certainly not engage 2 of them. And that's what it may come to if we're outnumbered. Well, as for the soldiers... He broke off, his head raised and intent, like a hound trying to catch an elusive scent. "Did you hear anything?" he asked. Both sat silent, concentrated, trying to pierce through the countless voices of the ship and the sea. "If it's not distant thunder, would it be gunfire at all?" asked Stephen. Jack nodded, ran on deck, sent the second lieutenant down into the hold, a capital place for catching the tremor of a broadside a great way off, and listened himself from the master's day cabin together with Harding. "Either Ramillies and Aboukir are engaging the St. Matthew's batteries, or the French are coming out with this nor'easter," said Jack. The second lieutenant joined them. "I believe it's a sea fight, sir," he said, panting with haste and emotion. "I clearly heard broadside for broadside, never the irregular fire of a battery." "Thank you, Mr. Summers," said Jack, who was of the same opinion. "Mr. Harding, a lee gun, if you please, and when Ringle is within hail, tell Mr. Reed to make the best of his way to Ramillies and say we shall be there as soon as possible. Grampus is to join us and observe our motions." Returning to the cabin, he darted an accusing eye at the coffee pot. But Killick, during the few moments he could spare from eavesdropping near the master's day cabin, had for his part observed the doctor's motions, as unscrupulous as ever where coffee and certain sweetmeats were concerned, and another pot was already on its way. "As I had hoped," said Jack with great satisfaction.
The French have taken advantage of this blessed northeast wind to attempt a sortie, and we...
He raised his voice very much indeed to carry above the bosun's.
All hands there! And the subsequent thunder of feet, emphatic orders, and the huge variety of sounds caused when a ship of the line, sailing large under courses and reef topsails, is suddenly required to change course from almost due south to west-northwest and spread all the canvas she can bear. And we're pelting up to join Ramillies and Aboukir, who seem to be engaging them. It'll take some time, since we have to bear up, but I have hopes that the wind will back westerly. Now, when I finish this glorious cup and change my good coat, I shall go and urge the ship on by force of mind. I shall also keep my fingers crossed, he added privately. He might indeed have indulged in even grosser forms of superstition, for this dreadful bay, thickly sown with rocks, isolated or in reefs, largely invisible through low cloud sheets of rain and even downright fog, called for a mind that could retain some hundreds of bearings and shift the internal chart according to the ship's speed and directions, never forgetting the local current and the all-important ebb and flow of the tide. Fortunately, Jack possessed this sort of mind, if not to perfection, then at least to a high degree. Furthermore, he'd been up and down this great stretch of water, patrolling all of it and surveying much for what seemed eternity. And above all, he was on terms of good understanding, friendship might be the better word, with the Bellona and her people. Reed in the tender had almost equal knowledge of the bay, since he'd accompanied his captain on most of his movements and surveys. And since the Ringle could lie so much closer to the wind, he was soon out of sight even when the murk parted. But the unhappy Grampus was perfectly new to Brest, and she kept so perilously close to the Bellona's stern that Jack stationed a hand with a speaking trumpet to warn her where he was about to tack, a fairly frequent exercise in these waters, though somewhat less so as the wind continued to veer westerly. From time to time, Stephen, resuming the tarpaulin jacket, stood in out-of-the-way places on the leeward side of the quarterdeck. The ship might have been sailing, perhaps at a very great speed, with everything, sea, foam, squalls, fog, in furious, apparently random motion it was impossible to judge, through a nightmare lit only by battle lanterns and through one of the noisier, unrecorded circles of the inferno. And it was both wonderful and comforting to see the wet, cheerful, unconcerned faces around him, perfectly willing to tally aft and belay, or leap into the rigging and vanish upwards at a pipe or the word of command, competent, at home, eagerly expectant. Space might scarcely exist, having lost all boundaries, but time was still with them, measured by bells. And at 6 bells in the middle watch, Stephen made his way cautiously down and down, the size of the ship still surprised him, to the sick berth, which, in comparison, was a gently lamp-lit haven of peace. So much so that his cystotomy and all the other patients and their attendants were fast asleep. He sat listening to the cystotomy's even breathing for a while, and then, noticing a change in the Bellona's motion, he returned to the quarterdeck, feeling that in this wild rush through the obscurity his presence, though useless, was called for by decency, if by nothing else. "There you are, Stephen," said Jack. "We've just reached the western end of the Black Rocks, and we're starting our run in for the Goulet. Do you hear them banging away? They're well to the east of St. Matthew's, right in the Goulet. Dear Lord, what a prodigious great deal of weather. Not a fit night out for man or beast, as the Centaur observed." With this western tendency in the turning wind, the Bellona now received it where she liked it best. And at 4 bells in the morning watch, the midshipman in charge of the log reported, 9 knots and 1 fathom, sir, if you please. Killick came out, shielding a jug of coffee, and as Jack came aft to share it with Stephen, he nodded towards a wicked swirl of white water a quarter of a mile on the starboard beam and said, "That's the Basse Royale. A death trap for a ship of our draught in a hollow sea near the bottom of the ebb, and over there," nodding to larboard,
You'd see the Bass Large, was you, on the poop, which is worse by far, but more obvious. Mr. Hewell, raising his voice, I believe we may shake out the reef in the foretopsail. The mingled cloud and fog lifted a little about this time, just before the first hint of day in the east, and its grey lower surface showed crimson with a stabbing gunfire ahead. Yes, they're right in the goulet by the Bass Bozac, said Jack. Happily, the St. Matthew's battery cannot see a thing perched up there. We shall have to pass right under their guns. Sail on the starboard bow, bawled a lookout, adding confidentially, Tender, I do believe. The ship ahoy, called a voice from that direction. What ship is that? Ballooner, Mr. Reed, said Jack. Come aboard. And directing his voice forward, Pass a line there. Stand by to fend off, cried Harding, careful for his paintwork. What's the position? Asked Jack as Reed came over the side. There are two French 74s, sir, said Reed, and they've battered Aboukir and Ramillies pretty badly. Aboukir stuck on the near Bass Bozac, and the Frenchmen would have boarded her, but Naiad came up and kept peppering them, while Ramillies hit one of them very hard. There was an explosion amidships. Very good. Just how does Aboukir lie? Reed explained. Then cut back and do what you can to lay out a kedge east-nor-east. With any luck, the tide should lift her in... He looked at his watch by the light of the binnacle. 20 minutes. Master Gunner, he called. And after a short, largely formal exchange with Mr. Mears, he said to his first lieutenant, Mr. Harding, let us beat to quarters. Stephen, he added in an aside, smiling as he spoke, away below with you, out of the falling damps. The Bellona surgeon and his assistant sat there in the cockpit, listening intently. The midshipman's sea chests lashed together under the lantern, covered with tarpaulins, then sailcloth, and then a fine white sheet made fast all round, stood in the middle. The instruments, shining clean and, where an edge was called for, shaving sharp, stood in their accustomed order, saws to the larboard. They listened. And even down here, the rumbling grumble of the French 74s, the Ramillies and the Naiad made the bottles tremble, while a little later the poor hard-hit Aboukir, lifting to the tide, brought her broadside to bear and returned the enemy fire with all the pent-up fury of a ship that has been punished without being able to reply. But their own battle, the Bellona's rippling broadsides they had heard so often during the great gun exercise, did not begin. And tense expectation was drooping even to the point of discontent when, with a wholly different and immediate sharpness, her bow-chasers fired, followed by the foremost guns of her starboard broadside, deep-voiced guns, loud and clear, firing well-spaced, carefully aimed, deliberate long shots. "It started!" cried Smith, who had seen no action. And as if in reply, a spent, harmless round shot hit the Bellona's side. Smith gazed at his colleagues with a wild enthusiasm. "What is it, Mr. Weatherby?" asked Stephen, seeing the boy come in. "The captain's compliments, sir, if you please. And Aboukir's surgeon will be most grateful for a hand with his casualties. There's a cutter alongside, if you please to come with me." "We are to expect no more action, I collect?" asked Stephen. He began filling a basket with instruments, bandages, pledgets, tourniquets, splints, laudanum. "Not at present, sir, I'm afraid. The Frenchmen are running for home." "It would have been temerity carried to a criminal pitch if the Frenchmen hadn't done so, when they were confronted with a resuscitated Aboukir, a largely intact Ramillies, a 38-gun frigate, and now two perfectly fresh and untouched two-deckers, particularly as one of the French ships of the line had had seven ports beaten into one and several guns dismounted by the explosion. Yet it was disappointing." "Call that an action?" asked Mr. Mears, addressing his mates. "I call it a fart in a blind alley. A genteel fart in a blind alley is what I call it.
and after all our hurry and preparation, all hands day and night, and cartridges filled without so much as a hot dinner, screen, ship, deck sanded and wetted, and who for God's sake needed any more water on a goddamn day like this?
"'Twas disappointing," said Jack, as Stephen joined him for what had to pass for breakfast. "'But there was no help.
"'Come, sir, if you please,'
said Killick, with a bucket of hot water, soap, towel, dressing gown. He guided Stephen into the quarter gallery, leaving him with the words,
"'You know the captain can't bear the sight of blood, "'and there you are, fair soaked from head to foot, "'and what poor Grimble and I shall do to the floor cloth "'with all them nasty footprints, I don't know. "'Now, take everything off, sir. "'Shirt, drawers, stockings and all, and throw them into that there bucket. "'I'll keep your coffee hot. His Honour won't mind waiting.'
Neither Captain Aubrey nor Dr. Maturin was an outstandingly meek or patient man, yet such was Killick's total conviction, his moral superiority, that the one waited for his longed-for coffee without complaint, and the other not only washed obediently, but would have shown both hands front and back if required.
"'Yes, it was disappointing,' said Jack, "'but there was no help for it.' The Frenchmen were hopelessly outnumbered, so, of course, as soon as they made out our full force, and as soon as Aboukir had lifted, they spread all the sail they could. Unhappily, they lost no more than a mizzen topmast between them in the action, and that don't signify, since now they have a leading wind.
They couldn't be pursued with this same leading wind, I presume.
Certainly they could be pursued, and by steady fire, yawing now and then for a broadside. We might well knock away a few spars and even conceivably take them right up in the Goulet before they could reach their friends in the inner bay. But how do you propose to bring them out with the wind in the west, the powerful tide against us too, and the fog lifting with the sun so that we're exposed to the batteries?
They heard a boat alongside reply, "Ramillies," to the sentinel's hail. And Jack hurried on deck to receive Captain Fanshawe.
"Come and have a cup of coffee," he said,
and brought him into the cabin. "You know Dr. Maturin, I believe?"
of course, long since. How do you do, sir? And so you have real coffee? We've been down to grains of barley roasted and ground these many weeks. How I should love a single draught of right Arabian mocha. Heavens, Jack, you were a welcome sight, you and poor old Grampus, heaving up out of the murk. I had a horrible feeling it was more Frenchmen coming to join their friends, a rendezvous, and we were in a wretched posture to receive them with Aboukir hard and fast. But, however, now the tables are turned. Oh, what glorious coffee! Turned as pretty as you could wish.
Turned indeed. And the doctor wants us to bring them out in triumph.
If we had some of those vessels that are set to sail against wind and tide, we might do so, said Fanshawe,
looking affectionately at Stephen.
But as we are only simple ships of the line, I believe we must return to our dreary blockade, sending word to the Admiral that Aboukir will probably have to go into Corsand Bay.
This they did.
Patching up the Aboukir, as well as the assembled carpenters and sailmakers could manage, although eastwards they heard remote but quite unmistakable and heavy gunfire borne on the still westerly breeze.
"Now,"
said Fanshawe,
"our orders are to patrol the bay, which implies preventing the enemy from coming out or getting in, and above all, from joining forces. If you like, I'll send Naiad and your tenders to see if either of them can find the flag and ask for orders. But that's as far as I can go. Our clear duty, as I see it, is to go up and down this vile bay until we're told to stop."
"You always was a pig-headed brute, Billy," said Jack. But this was a totally unofficial aside. They were alone in the cabin, and it was taken as such. In point of fact, Captain Aubrey and all the rest continued to go up and down that vile bay, blockading the port of Brest, and growing steadily hungrier. Up and down until a little before 2 bells in the afternoon watch of Friday. A brisk topsail breeze at southwest, the weather clear, a moderate southern swell, when the Bellona's masthead and every other masthead belonging to the inshore squadron reported a sail, 4 points on the larboard bow. As they were then heading for St. Matthew's, the sail was clearly from Ushant. And since she was travelling fast with a favourable breeze, further details came down at quite short intervals. On deck there, a three-decker, sir. On deck there, a brig and a ship in her wake. Storeship, I believe. On deck there, the Charlotte, sir. Well before that awe-inspiring but scarcely unexpected name, the captain's servants began titivating their master's best uniform against the almost inevitable signal, Captain's Repair Aboard the Flag, and the first lieutenants hurried about anxiously looking for imperfections that might bring discredit on the ship. Unhappily, there was no time for blacking the yards, but at least everything that should be taut was tautened with tackles, Spanish Burtons, or just plain heaving staves, while the dirtier midshipmen were sent below to wash, while all were desired to brush their hair, change their shirts and put on gloves. Aboard the Bellona, every urgent measure had been taken, and they were beginning the fine work, such as whitening lanyards, when, with real concern, they saw the flagship round to and at once begin to lower down her barge. Captain Fanshawe was the senior captain present, and his ship, the Admiral's natural victim, was seized with a renewed frenzy of zeal, her people hurrying about like ants in an overturned anthill. But they were mistaken. Very soon it became apparent that the barge was heading for Bellona, whose Royal Marine officers now conducted the most rapid and thorough-paced review of their 120-odd men in the history of the Corps, finishing only when the barge, in answer to the wholly superfluous hail, replied, "Flag!" and hooked on. Lord Stranraer came nimbly up the side, followed by his flag lieutenant, and a much duller figure in a blue coat with no gold lace, the Queen Charlotte's surgeon, Mr. Sherman. The Admiral saluted the quarterdeck, and acknowledged the Marine's flashing presentation of arms and Jack's salute by touching his hat and saying, "Captain Aubrey, I hope you and all the other captains of the inshore squadron will dine with me this afternoon. But for the moment, Mr. Sherman and I should like to see Dr. Maturin." "Certainly, my lord," said Jack. "If you choose to walk into the cabin, I'll desire him to join you. In the meantime, may I offer you a glass of Madeira?" Jack, Harding, and all those who had any pride in the ship's beauty and her seamanlike appearance had done virtually everything in human power to make it impossible for any candid eye, however severe, to find fault with her. They knew that the Admiral couldn't honestly say that her yards were not exactly squared, nor could he complain that the hens had flung their litter about the deck, a not unusual grievance, when there was nothing else to blame, because no poultry whatsoever had survived the dearth. But they had never thought of Stephen. No one had washed, brushed or dusted Dr. Maturin, and he came up in more than his usual squalor, unshaved, fresh, if such a word can be used, from his greasy, malodorous task of dissecting the inedible parts of yet another porpoise. None of this disturbed the Admiral, stickler though he was for precision and uniform. "My dear Dr. Maturin," he cried, leaping from his chair and coming forward with outstretched hand, "I couldn't miss this opportunity of coming across to express my sense of your great goodness in prescribing for me. I knew it would answer your physic, but I had no idea it would answer so prodigious well. I was in the main top this morning, sir. I ran up to the top. I'd hoped to be allowed to consult you, but Mr. Sherman here assured me it would never do. It would be quite impossible, that he had a lien upon me, and that no physical gentleman of your eminence would consent to examine one of his patients without he was there." "Sure, Mr. Sherman was in the right of it entirely," said Stephen. "In the medical world we too have our conventions, perhaps as rigid as those of the service. Some of them are puzzling to patients who, in the wild licentiousness of their imaginations, suppose that they can wander from physician to surgeon to quacksalver and back again, just as the whim bites. And some are on occasion thought offensive, such as our rule of using Latin when we discuss the sufferer's case in his presence. This has its advantages, such as extreme accuracy of definition, and from the nature of the language, an admirable concision. But if my colleague agrees, I should be perfectly happy if we were both to examine you."
Bows all round, and Captain Aubrey withdrew. The examination was thorough, and although Killick, on the other side of the door, was of a contrary opinion, once they start talking foreign, mate, it's all up. You can send for the sexton as soon as you like. Here lieth Arthur Grimble, died with the Marthambles, breast bearing west by north 10 leagues, 1814. Profoundly satisfactory. Stephen's only advice was extreme caution with the digitalis, dose to be steadily diminished, patient not to be told the name of the drug, still less allowed access to it. More men, particularly sailors, have died from self-administered doses than ever the enemy killed in action, he observed. And turning to the Admiral, my lord, you are the most gratifying of patients. The anomalies that we noticed before have virtually disappeared. And if you'll run up to the main top every morning, half an hour after a light breakfast, and observe Mr. Sherman's precepts, I see no reason why you should not rival Methusalem and succeed officers as yet unborn as Admiral of the Fleet. How well you speak, dear Doctor, said the Admiral. I'm infinitely obliged to you, both, bowed to Sherman, for your advice and care. He put on his clothes, and with a certain embarrassment asked Stephen to dine aboard the Charlotte with Aubrey and the other captains. Lord Stranraer's dinner was as splendid, as far as the food was concerned, as anyone would expect from a flagship. But for the captains of the inshore squadron, deprived of almost everything for so long, it was far, far beyond even the most fervent expectations, and they ate with a steady intensity of greed from the first course to the last. There was almost no conversation apart from just another leg, if you please, or, well, perhaps another couple of slices, or may I trouble you for the bread barge? The captain of the fleet, however, who sat next to Stephen at the foot of the table, entertained him in a low, confidential voice to a very highly detailed account of his digestive processes, his very complicated and prolonged digestive processes, and a catalogue of the substances he could not eat. On the subject, his usually pale, phlegmatic face grew pink and assumed a look almost of enthusiasm. He was dealing with the effect of cardamom in all its varieties when he became aware of a silence all along the table and of the Admiral at its head clearly poised to make an announcement. Gentlemen, he said, before we drink the loyal toast, I think I should give you some news that may perhaps incline you to drink it with even greater fervour. But first, since contrary winds and foul weather have cut most of you off from the world for so long, not for nothing do we call certain parts of this station Siberia, I may be allowed to give you a short account of recent events on the continent. It may well be imperfect. There are many landborne officials who don't always understand the seaman's hunger for news, but in the main I think it accurate enough. I dare say you're all aware that Napoleon suffered a severe defeat before Leipzig some months ago, but that even so he beat the Germans and Austrians again and again. He was doing so even a week or two ago, but that was his undoing. His forces are all away in the northeast, his left flank is open, and the Allies are marching upon an almost undefended Paris. Wellington, as you know, has taken Toulouse. He's now crossed the Adour, and he's moving north at a great pace. At present, there's some kind of a congress meeting at Châtillon, but since Napoleon was offered reasonable terms 3 times, even after Leipzig, and refused them all, he'll gain nothing from this congress now that he has no organised army at all. The ships that sailed from Brest and those we met with west of Ushant had intended to join by way of a final fling, but they never met. The gallant Captain Fanshawe here and Beveridge offshore put an end to their capers. Many hands beat
discreetly on the table. Many officers raised their glasses, bowing to Fanshawe and Beveridge. And the Admiral went on, "It's usually considered unlucky to predict a fortunate outcome of anything whatsoever. But on this occasion, I shall be so bold as to foretell a sensible end to this Congress and Chatillon, the downfall of Napoleon, the end of this war, and our return to England, home and beauty. Gentlemen, the King." Something of this speech reached the ships of the inshore squadron, but without much force. The end of the war had been foretold so very often. And as Killick, who stood behind Jack's chair, had found Lord Stranraer's manner of speaking difficult to follow, all that the lower deck gathered at first was that there was to be a new King of France called Chatillon, or something like that, probably related to Wellington. And in any case, all public and private attention was taken up by the storeship, crammed with food, drinks, slops, spars, cordage, sailcloth, everything they'd been lacking for so long. And even more, there was an abundant post. In the dog watches, very little of the ship's ordinary work was done. And once the precious stores were stowed, little groups formed round the more literate. And while his friend stood at a discreet distance, a man would listen while his letter was read out. For once, no cruel tidings reached the Bellona, which, for a ship's company of more than 600 men and boys, nearly all with close and mortal relatives, and a long absence of mail, was very far from common. The mild, domestic news from Woolcombe was charmingly uneventful, though Sophie's bantam had brought off a clutch of minute chicks. Diana and Clarissa were settling into their wing, furnishing the dining room with walnut objects of the last age, which they found at auctions, sometimes travelling up to 50 miles for a handsome piece. And it was rumoured that Captain Griffiths meant to sell and move to London. Yet in spite of this deep and abiding contentment, Jack was low in his spirits. "Do you think the Admiral's account was reasonably sound?" he asked. "It certainly coincides with what I've heard," said Stephen. "A sad booby I must have looked, prating away to you about the French Navy and my fear of a long war with them building away at a great pace." "I thought it perfectly reasonable from a naval point of view. And you couldn't tell that on land Bonaparte had completely lost his wits. It was almost unbelievable how he threw away his chances and countless lives in these last few months." Jack shook his head. And after a while he said, "I don't mean to say a single syllable against William Fanshawe, but upon my word, I think the Admiral might have mentioned Bellona. He'll not do so in his dispatch either. Yet our people work like demons. All hands, watch upon watch, to get her up there in time, and it would have been a bloody disaster if she hadn't arrived. From a purely selfish point of view, I'm so glad you told me about your scheme for Chile. There's to be no distinction for me this side of the ocean. I don't mean to topic the tragedy, Queen Stephen, and I shouldn't say this to anyone else, but I feel the yellow rising about my gills." "Come in," he cried. Harding came in, bringing the son with him. "Forgive me for bursting upon you like this, sir, but I've had such a pleasing letter. My wife has just inherited a little estate in Dorset from a distant cousin. It lies between Plush and Folly. I am to be Squire of Plush." "Give you joy with all my heart," said Jack, shaking his hand. "We shall be neighbours. My son's at school there, Mr. Randall's school. How happy my wife and I'll be. But I'm afraid that I must warn you that Plush often leads to folly." "Why?" "Yes, sir," began Harding, somewhat staggered. But then he caught the nature of Captain Aubrey's witticism, perhaps the best thing Jack had ever said, which depended on a knowledge of the fact that when grog was served out,
The ordinary members of each mess of seamen received slightly less than the regular measure. By ancient custom, the amount of grog left, which was called plash, belonged to the cook of the mess. And unless he had a good head for rum, this often led him to commit a foolish action. Jack's gravity hadn't lasted quite as long as Harding's, and his wholehearted mirth continued for some moments after Harding had recovered himself. But he received the wardroom's invitation with a decent complacence.
"That's certainly the best thing I've ever heard in the naval line," said Harding, "and I shall write it down. How Eleanor will roar! But my errand is really to beg for the honour of your company to dinner in the wardroom tomorrow. We've been shocking remiss these many, many weeks, but now that the storeship has found out where we lie at last, we hope to make up at least some of our leeway."
When he was speaking to Stephen about the Admiral, Jack hadn't made a good many of the unkind reflections that had naturally occurred to him. He had not, to take a very small example, said that Lord Stranraer's claret was meagre in quantity and execrable in quality. His lordship had no taste whatsoever for wine, never drank it for pleasure himself, was convinced that others judged only by label and price, and that if they saw neither, they would never know the difference. Because he'd seen the Admiral's evident esteem for Stephen, and he didn't know whether the liking might be returned. In any event, the wardroom's dinner to their captain couldn't possibly have led to such a reproach, uttered or suppressed. Dr. Maturin was, of course, a wardroom officer. He usually looked after the wine, and for occasions such as this, when the claret brought out by the storeship in casks had neither been bottled nor given a moment of rest after a violent tossing about, he'd provided a very old, very full-bodied Priorato. It went down extremely well. But it was, of course, considerably stronger than most Bordeaux, and the conversation up and down the table was somewhat louder, more general and less restrained than usual. The table itself was a fine sight, with a dozen officers sitting there, mostly blue and gold, with the marine scarlet coats setting them off pleasantly, and their servants standing behind their chairs. But the general mood was one of anxious uncertainty, repressed out of consideration for their guest, but evident enough for one who had been so long at sea. He looked down the table, considering the many faces he knew, and in a momentary silence he heard a hand on deck call out, "Mark of the forebrace down, sir," and the officer of the watch reply, "Belay-o." "Belay-o," said Jack to the table in general. "From all I see in the papers Queen Charlotte brought us, and from what I heard aboard the flag, it seems to me that all of us will have to belay very soon. Tie up, belay, and pay off." A pause while he finished his glass of wine. "War, of course, is a bad thing," he went on, "but it is our way of life. Has been these 20 years and more. And for most of us, it is our only hope of a ship, let alone of promotion. And I well remember how my heart sank in the year 2, the year of the Peace of Amiens. But let me offer this reflection by way of comfort. In the year 2, my spirits were so low that if I could have afforded a piece of rope, I should have hanged myself. Well, as everyone knows, that piece didn't last. And in the year 4, I was made post, jobbing captain of Lively, and a lively time we had of it too. I throw this out because if one piece with an untrustworthy enemy can be broke, another piece with the same fella can be broke too. And our country will certainly need defending, above all by sea. So," filling his glass again, "let's drink to the paying off, and may it be a peaceful orderly and cheerful occasion, followed by a short, I repeat, very short, run ashore.